Well, hello and welcome to the Morning Bible Study. It is 16th July 2020 and we are in 2 Samuel chapter 20. So why don't you go ahead and give 2 Samuel chapter 20 a read. If you read through it yesterday, awesome, you get to read through it again today. And we are going to particularly pick up where we left off with dealing with the rebellion of Sheba, son of Bichri. Okay, so go ahead and read it, especially from verses 11 through the end of the chapter, and then we will unpause your audio and we will dive into the text. So I had you start in verse 11. If I really wanted everybody to read the whole chapter all the way over again, but if you began in verse 11, you see that there has been Joab stabs again. You know that I think I told before that I used to have my Bible study students. I taught them to remember the name Joestab because it's. I mean, once you hear Joestab, you kind of associate Joab with stabbing, and you kind of remember the story. But anyways, so. There's the death of Amasa, who was unable to muster the troops in time. Joab is now in command, and Joab, this guy who's willing, he's willing to stab his own cousin or nephew, however, whatever the relationship is, we're not exactly sure. He's willing to do that. So Joab is a guy who's kind of maybe a little bit difficult to predict. Okay. And so they're following Sheba, son of Bichri. They're pursuing him. This guy's a rebel. And Sheba traveled through all the tribes of Israel to Abel of Bethmaachah, or Abel Bethmaachah. You can the NET adds the word of. And, you know, it's typically, I think historically, we've just called that place Abel Bethmaachah. But, you know, it is also just known as this, according to the NET Bible. And when they had assembled, so basically Sheba got there. And when they assembled, that is when the troops assembled, they too joined him. And so who are they? Well, the NET Bible says the translation here follows the Koray, which so there are in the Hebrew Bible the Masoretic text, which is the basis for all Hebrew translations. Let me take a pause here. So I got to explain this, so I can explain that, so I can explain the text note. Okay, there are a couple layers here. So the New Testament is not based on any single manuscript of the Bible. Okay, there is no single manuscript that the New Testament follows. All modern translations, and in fact, the King James, by the way, some King James people will tell you, it's based on Textus Receptus. Not a thing, okay? All translations of the Bible you have today, with the exception maybe, even your modern Catholic translations, if there are any modern Catholic translations that still try to be a translation of the Vulgate, the Latin Vulgate, the Biblia Sacra Vulgata, which is the Latin Vulgate, was still based upon an eclectic text. So all translations of the Bible, unless you have like some obscure one that is only a translation of an individual manuscript, which I don't know of a single one that is, but from a major publisher, all of them are what are called critical texts. And a critical text is, in the New Testament, what they do is they look at every text available, every available version of the Bible, and they try to determine what the original wording was, because the Bible varies in tiny, tiny ways. Okay, I've talked about this before. I'll talk about it again. I'm sure I'll talk about it again in the future. There are variants. There are changes. Most of them are completely insignificant. They're changes in spelling, like changes in spelling that you can't even translate into English. Like, is John spelled with one N or two? Is there a movable new at the end of the third person masculine singular verb, which has nothing to do with meaning? Okay, like untranslatable differences is the vast majority. Okay, and what they do is they look at all the available texts and they create what's called a critical text. Okay, so on my shelf right now, I'm looking at the UBS 4, which is also the same as the Nestle Aland number 27, I think it is. And then I've got the Novum Testament Graece, which is the Nestle Aland 28. And then I've also got, and so I've also got a couple other versions of the Greek Bible on my shelf. But every so many years, they come up with updated versions of these, and most of the modern translations will update based upon that. Now, they make their own decisions. Sometimes they differ from what the critical, the going critical text of the day is, whether it's UBS 4, UBS 5, NA27, NA28. They make their own decisions. That's called a critical text. They are critically assessing all of the variants to determine with their skills what the best approximation of the original wording was, the exact original wording and the exact original spelling. And they also add punctuation just because, you know, we use punctuation nowadays, and it helps for clarity. It's a decision. The Old Testament is not like that. The Old Testament, okay, so I've got also on my shelf, I'm looking at right now, it's the Biblia Hebraica Stuttgartensia. And what that is a version of the Masoretic text. Okay, it's called the MT, the Masoretic text. And the Masoretes were these guys that were Jews, and they added vowel pointing, and they added a whole bunch of other text notes into the Bible. And we use this. And so instead of using a critical text, though, we use the Masoretic text. Now, the Masoretes had these places where in their notes they would have a Q and a K. The Q means kare, which means read. And the K means kathiv, which means write. Now, kathiv means write, which means if you're copying this text, okay, if you're copying this text, this is what you write, because this is the writing we have. But know that that's probably incorrect, so read this. That's called kathiv kare, or the Q and the K, and that rhymes all the way, all day, every day. You want to, you know, eat some hay, make something out of clay, lay by the bay. I don't know. I just may. What do you say? I've seen Happy Gilmore before. So, you know, you've got that going on. And so right here, there's this note that says the translation follows the Koray. So now we know what the Koray is. The Koray is where the ancient Hebrew scholars looked at the text and they're like, the way that it's written doesn't really make sense, but we're not going to change it. We're just going to make this note that says, yeah, this is probably wrong, so this is what you want to read instead. So the translation follows the Koray. Many medieval Hebrew manuscripts and the ancient versions in reading, what do they read? They read, they were gathered together rather than the kathiv, and they cursed him. Okay? So the note continues, and I skipped over some of the parts that were in Hebrew. But what basically they said, when they assembled, they too joined him. So why do we have this? Well, because clearly the men who were following Sheba didn't, you know, curse him and then join him. Okay? So, I mean, it's possible. It's possible that that's what they did. I mean, you could make a case, and certainly one of the canons of textual criticism is to say which is the more difficult reading. Okay, so sometimes when you're trying to decide which is correct, you say, well, typically scribes change things to make it easier to understand, not harder. So a lot of times, one of the ways you can test is if it's the harder reading, maybe that gives it some credence. Well, there's also something called, you know, a too difficult reading, right? Like, it's the harder reading. It's also impossibly difficult. So we're not going to make any sense of this. Okay, anyways. So Amasa, we've read about Amasa. We've read about Sheba. He's gathering his men together. But then Joab's men come in verse 15. And they laid siege against him in Abel of Bethmaachah. They prepared a siege ramp outside the city, which stood against its outer rampart. Okay, they've come, they've gathered, the whole army of Israel is gathered against Abel of Bethmaachah. I'm just going to call Abel Bethmaachah from now on because that's just easier for me. And they've gathered together, and they've built a siege ramp. Okay, so Joab isn't just some chump, and he's also not waiting around. So the first thing they did is they didn't like, you know, wave the flag and call for a parley. Like, no, like immediately the first thing he does is he starts building a siege ramp, and he says, yeah, we're going to take the city. We're not messing around. Which tells you something about Joab, who Joab is. Joab is not a guy who likes to screw around. He's the guy who gets stuff done. That's why, you know, part of the reason why he felt justified in stabbing Amasa and taking control, because he's a guy who does stuff. And so they're all the soldiers were trying to break through the wall so that it would collapse. And then verse 26, a wise woman called out of the city, listen up, tell Joab, come near so that I may speak to you. Okay, so Joab has already had a conversation with a wise woman. Now, remember, we talked about wise women a few weeks ago, I don't remember exactly when. But wise women, we don't know exactly what the wise woman was, except that she was a woman who was wise. Okay, so Is a wise woman an actress? Possibly. Is a wise woman involved in some kind of cultic ritual, like a witch? Possibly. Is a wise woman like a term used for a woman who was just generally understood to be wise and had some kind of matriarchal influence in a city? Possibly. We don't know what a wise woman was, other than we know she was a woman who was wise. But the point I'm making is, it seems like it's a fixed construction. It's not just like saying that she's a wise adjective woman noun. It seems like she's a wise woman, like a you put those together and it becomes a noun. Okay, so this wise woman, she comes out and she says, you know, I want to talk to Joab. And they're battering down the city walls at this point. And so Joab comes up to her and he says, and the woman says, "Are you Joab?" And he says, "I am." And she said, "Listen to the words of your servant." He said, "Go ahead, I'm listening." She said, "In the past, they would always say, 'Let them inquire in Abel.' And that is how they settled things. I represent the peaceful and the faithful in Israel. You are attempting to destroy an important city in Israel." The word is a mother in Israel. I don't like that the Net Bible made that change. I think that it's important to know that she's a mother in Israel. You're trying to destroy a city and a mother. I think that that's important because this is a woman speaking. And she's taught, and I think you can understand the metaphor of calling a city a mother in Israel. I don't think that you need to this. I really like the Net Bible. I think it's really good for a lot of things. But I really like its notes. I really like its translation notes. I think that they're very good. I think they did a really good job of translating. I just don't know that I agreed with this choice. So, you know, I know that I sound picky. I know that I'm always bashing the Net Bible, but you don't see when I'm, like, not bashing it because I don't comment on that. But anyways, so she says, "You're attempting to destroy a mother in Israel. Why should you swallow up the Lord's inheritance?" Okay, so basically the woman comes out and she says, "Listen, Abel is a famous city. We are famous for our wisdom. And the reason we're famous for our wisdom is because we've had these wise people here. And if people had a dispute, they would come here and they would get justice in this dispute." Now, this is a significant comment. Why? What is she saying? She's telling Joab, "Listen, we're reasonable people. We're people who can be persuaded. We're people who make good decisions." Okay? Not only is she emphasizing the importance of the city, she's emphasizing the reasonableness of the city. Okay, the justice of the city. This was a city that acted as an adjudicator for disputes. So they understand justice, they understand law, they understand compromise and arbitration, right? So what she's saying is, "Let's make a deal." And then she follows it up with, she says, "Let's make a deal, and we're peaceful. We're not at war with David. Abel Beth-Maacah did not start this fight. You are trying to destroy a mother in Israel. Why should you swallow up the Lord's inheritance?" And so listen to her rebuke. This woman is very intelligent. Now, this is the thing that we often miss in the Bible, is when we look at people's dialogue, we forget, we just read it at face value, and we should read it at face value, but we should also recognize the meaning of what is conveyed, not simply the words. Ask, why is she saying the things that she says? See, I think all too often we don't ask that question. We don't ask the follow-up question. All we look at it are the immediate results of direct discourse in the Bible. And that's good to know, but look into the text. Don't just look at the surface level. I mean, if all we look at the surface level is, she says, "Let them inquire at Abel," and that's how they settled things. Okay, interesting. What does that have to do with Sheba, son of Bichri? Well, nothing. And everything. If all we're thinking about is that, Joab is coming to get Sheba, and this woman starts talking, and she's talking about, you know, how the city, you know, used to have this reputation. Who cares? Let's move on. We're missing the point. We're missing the point of what she's trying to communicate. She's saying this is a city that understands arbitration and justice, and we're willing to deal. More than that, we are at peace, and we want to remain at peace. We are a mother in Israel, not a father. We're a place where life comes from. Why would you bring death to a place of life? Because that's what mothers are. Mothers, not just women, not women. I'm not saying women are. Mothers are givers of life. By definition, you are a mother if you give life. She's saying, "Joab, we are wise. We know how to make deals. We understand arbitration. And more than that, we are a giver of life. This city brings life to Israel, and you are trying to destroy. You are trying to swallow up the Lord's inheritance. And then what does she do? You're trying to swallow up the Lord's, Yahweh's inheritance. She's saying your actions are contrary to Yahweh. You are against God right now. This is a very intelligent woman. She's a very intelligent woman. But she, does she know Joab? Does she know how Joab's going to respond to this very gentle rebuke? She doesn't. But maybe she knew more about Joab than we think, because this is what Joab says. The Net Bible says, get serious. Get serious. I don't want to swallow up, destroy anything. The translation note says, the Hebrew literally says, far be it from me, far be it from me. The expression is clearly emphatic, as may be seen in part by the repetition. P.K. McCarter, however, understands it to be coarser than the translation adopted here. He renders it as, I'll be damned if etc., which, while it is not a literal translation, may not be too far removed from the way a soldier might have expressed himself. So the Net Bible, tries to strike the middle between the hyper-literal, far be it from me, far be it from me, which, by the way, I feel like there's nothing wrong with far be it from me, far be it from me. Again, I don't know that we need to translate that out of Hebrew into some kind of meaning for meaning equivalent. I think it's perfectly understandable what that means, because we use that expression in English. But the Net tries to find this moderating position between far be it from me, far be it from me, and I'll be damned if I do that. That's an interesting translation. I don't know that I've ever seen that. So he says, I don't want to swallow up or destroy anything. That's not the way things are. There's a man from the hill country of Ephraim named Sheba, son of Bichri. Okay, he's from the hill country of Ephraim, but he's a Benjamite. Okay, so from the hill country of Ephraim named Sheba, son of Bichri. He has rebelled against King David. Give me just this one man and I will leave the city. Okay, so what does Joab say? She says, Joab, this is a city that knows how to make a deal. We want peace. Let me summarize. Let me read between the lines here. Actually, three things. She says, we know how to make a deal. We want peace. And you are going to do something that is offensive to God, because we're at peace with you and we know how to make a deal. So you bringing violence against us is unwarranted and uncalled for. And Joab says, no, lady. He says, I don't want to swallow up or destroy anything. Basically, he's saying, look, you think I want to go and build siege ramps against cities in Israel? I do not. That is not my game. That ain't my bag, lady. Okay, since we're just going willy-nilly with our translation, I'm going to go willy-nilly with my paraphrase. Listen, you know, chica, I'm doing what I have to do, because you've got Sheba, son of Bichri, who's a rebel. Give me just this one man, and I will leave the city. He doesn't even want all of Sheba's followers. He's not, and listen to what Joab does. Joab knows that Sheba has followers in the city. He knows he has followers in the city. But what does Joab do? He makes it easier. He makes it easier for them to avert war. Joab is very wise. I don't think we give Joab near the credit he deserves for his wisdom and his cleverness. And frankly, like I've said, David is a good man who did bad things. Joab is a bad man who did good things. Over and over, we see Joab and we see like this mixed bag of him either stabbing people or him showing circumspect wisdom. Here's another place where he's showing circumspect wisdom. He realizes that if they demand all of the rebels, what are the rebels likely to do? They're likely to seize control of the city and they're likely to make a long, drawn-out, bloody siege. They're all going to die. They're all going to die. If it turns to that. But a lot of Joab's men will die too, and it'll be ludicrously expensive, and it'll be destructive, and it'll serve no purpose. Strike the shepherd, and the sheep will be scattered. Joab understands this proverb, probably because he grew up raising sheep. Strike the shepherd, and the sheep will be scattered. Joab knows that most of the men who followed Sheba were, you know, low-level malcontents. They weren't really rebels in the true fullest sense. They might have been rebels, but they weren't revolutionaries. Most of them were disaffected and discontented, disenfranchised people who followed Sheba. They thought their life was going to get better. Did they deserve to be punished? Yeah, they did. They did. But they're really not after them. And maybe with this little show of force, they'll demonstrate that, you know, crime doesn't pay. And so Joab says, I'm going to make this as easy as possible for you. You don't have to get rid of all the rebels. Just give me Joab. Now, all the rebels are probably quite scared at this point. Or I'm sorry, just give me Sheba. All the rebels are probably pretty scared at this point. They're ready to fight to the death, but I don't really think they're that keen on it. I don't think they're that keen on it. Why do I not think they're that keen on it? Because they hold up in a city. Rather than being out in the wilderness, not being hemmed in. Saul understood, and Saul was right, that when David entered Keilah and wanted to stay there, that he had trapped himself. You know, a fortified city is a great defense. It's also a gilded cage. Because you're stuck there in a siege. And so Joab says to them, he's like, hey, just give me this guy. Give me this guy and I'll leave. I'll leave the city. The soldiers free to go, no problem. And the woman said, this very minute his head will be thrown over the wall to you. And the woman went to all the people with her wise advice. The text tells us, again, it's wise advice. And they cut off Sheba's head, and they threw it out to Joab. Joab blew the trumpet, and his men dispersed from the city, each going to his own home. Joab returned to the king in Jerusalem. Okay, why are we told that the wise woman gave wise advice after we know that the advice she gave was wise? Because it's emphasizing wisdom. Joab blew the trumpet, his men dispersed from the city, each going to his own home. Joab returned to the king of Jerusalem. Now Joab was the general in command of all the army of Israel. Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, was over the Kirathites and the Perathites. Adoniram was supervisor of the work crews. Jehoshaphat, son of Ahilud, was the secretary. Sheva was the scribe. And Zadok and Abiathar were the priests. Ira, the Jairite, was David's personal priest. Verse 23. Now Joab was the commander, was the general in command. David cannot get rid of Joab. The sons of Zeruiah, they were too strong for him. But what do we see from this text? What are we supposed to gather from this text? I think that what we're supposed to gather are three things. One is that rebellion doesn't pay. Rebellion doesn't pay. It's a bad thing to be a rebel. So don't be a rebel. The second thing we learn is that Joab, we actually get another character insight into Joab, which is worth looking at, which is that he's a bad man who does some pretty good things. You know, we see this back to back with Amasa, he commits cold-blooded murder. With the city of Abel Beth Maacah, he shows incredible restraint. And it is really, really hard to get a line on Joab. If you understand Joab, please, I am not being facetious, I'm not being sarcastic. If you have insight into Joab, please let me know, because I have, for a decade, I have been studying this man, and I think he's one of the most fascinating people in the Bible, and I just can't get my finger on him. I don't know what to make of Joab. Because in some ways, he seems like just the worst guy in the world. And in other ways, you're like, well, is he though? Is he? Because here he shows incredible restraint and wisdom and tact and circumspection. Joab is so hard to understand. He is the picture of the complex human, right? He is what drives anthropologists either wild with joy or wild with frustration, okay? And then, of course, we have the wise woman. And again, we have this mysterious use of the expression wise woman, but we look at what she says. And I think that what this should remind us of, what should this remind us of? Well, we see another wise woman, right? Now, the wise woman also was dealing with, the previous wise woman and Joab interaction had to do with what? With Absalom and petitioning the king. Here, so the first wise woman incident, the wise woman at Joab's behest is trying to bring Absalom, the rebel, back to the city. Now, with this incident with Joab and the wise woman, they're trying to get the rebel to die. Okay? So we've got this interesting, like, this history repeating kind of thing, which is creating an interesting pattern. And we see that David's interaction with women and important women in the book of Samuel is creating this interesting pattern. Okay, we see especially women of wisdom and women of tact. We see women of wisdom and tact having important power in the storyline with Hannah. With Hannah, with David's wife, Michal. I mean, she was not a wise woman, perhaps, but she was a woman of influence. We see the Witch of Endor. We see we see Abigail. We see the wise woman earlier. We see the wise woman of Abel Beth Maacah. What we see in 2 Samuel and 1 Samuel, the Samuel material, is really interesting because in the Samuel material, we see that women have a lot of influence. And at important turning points in the story, we see women taking important roles. Now again, I don't want to, you know, pretend that history was something other than what it was, but I also think that pretending that the entire history of the world has been, you know, brutal, oppressive patriarchy, I think ignores the biblical text. The biblical text is pretty clear. I don't know that that happened often. And in fact, when there has been brutal patriarchy and oppressive patriarchy, it has not been in the godly societies. It has been in the godless societies. Rome did that. Pagan nations did that within Israel. At one of the spiritual high points of Israel, what do we see the relationship of men to women being? Women have positions of prominence and are respected for their wisdom and leadership. Like, again, I'm not saying that the culture wasn't predominantly patriarchal, but it wasn't toxically patriarchal. It wasn't destructively patriarchal. It was patriarchal in the sense that men held the political and familial authority. But that doesn't mean that women had no authority. Just because somebody's a leader doesn't mean other people can't be leaders under that leader. You know, we make that mistake of a painting with too broad a brush. Now, I know I'm going rather long on this, and this really isn't something I had intended to talk about, but I think it's important. When we read the Bible, and particularly books like Samuel, books like Mark. Mark, by the way, I'm preaching through Mark right now, but Mark does the same thing. In Mark, we see important events revolving and turning around the actions of women. Okay, here in 2 Samuel and 1 Samuel, like I said, we see a lot of importance in women. Women are driving the narrative. Bathsheba, by the way. Bathsheba may drive the narrative in 2 Samuel as much as anybody does. Maybe more than just about anybody. And so we see women as being not only turning point characters, but we see women as being fully formed people characters. And when I say characters, I don't mean that they're fictional. I mean the way that they're portrayed by the biblical text. The biblical text doesn't treat women as like filler material. The biblical text treats women as fully formed and fully fledged human beings with their own agency and their own goals and their own purposes. Women have tremendous importance in the book of 2 Samuel and 1 Samuel, the Samuel material. And what we see is women like Abel Beth Maacah who have their own agendas. You know, and that's one of the big criticisms of patriarchy and the way that women are portrayed in Hollywood is that women only exist in Hollywood as a fulfillment of male desire. Well, I don't know. I haven't studied enough film carefully to say whether or not that's true, but maybe it does to a certain extent. But here in the Bible, you know how women aren't portrayed? Women aren't portrayed that way. Women are portrayed as having their own agendas, their own goals, their own agency. Women do things on their own for their own reasons. And they control and direct events that happen in the world, even within a society where family, religious, and political power predominantly resided within a patriarchal structure. So patriarchy doesn't mean misogyny. That's important to recognize. Patriarchy does not equate with misogyny. And what we see a lot is, in fact, the opposite, that within these patriarchal structures, there's protection for women to live out their fullest sense of who they are and who they can be. You know, we see, look at the biblical text. Look at the way daughters are treated by godly people in the biblical text. Look at the way that people treat wives and women, the language that's used by godly people in the biblical text. Now, am I saying that everything has been sunshine and roses for women in history? No, it hasn't been for men either, by the way. But But what we see when we look at the biblical text is that when people are godly, and when people, I believe, are living in a predominantly patriarchal structure, a structure that is complementarian, if you want to use that language, that frees women to not try to be men. Women shouldn't be men. And you know what? Men shouldn't be women. Women should be allowed to be women in everything that means. In everything that means. And so I think actually we do women a tremendous disservice, our culture does, when we say that women have to just be men with breasts. Okay? Men with breasts aren't women. I mean, they are biologically, but men with breasts aren't women. They're just men with breasts. Female chauvinist pigs, as the book is written. Women have the right to be women. Mothers have the right to be mothers. And I believe what the Bible shows us is that a godly patriarchal structure led by godly men is the best structure for giving women the freedom to exercise their God-given gifts in a way that pleases God and is ultimately good for society. Now, you might think that that sounds terrible and grotesque and misogynistic, but it really isn't. It really isn't misogynistic. In fact, I think the thing that hates women and hates womanhood is saying that women just need to be men with breasts, that women don't have the freedom to be women. I think that hates women. I think that inherently hates femininity and womanhood. I think womanhood is a wonderful thing. I think God designed womanhood to be the other half of manhood. And incidentally, I think God designed manhood to be the other half of womanhood. They are different in role, different in purpose, different by design. I think actual misogyny is pretending that women have to be just the same as men. I think that the demeaning and denigration of motherhood as somehow less than working a 40-hour a week job, I think that hates women. I think that's misogynistic. I think that's, and more than that, I think it's cruel, because I found in my life that many, many women who have taken the task to walk away from regular work and become a full-time wife and mother, they found that that is actually a lot harder to do, but it's also more fulfilling. I think that pretending that women have to go and work in the world and just be men with breasts, I think that's misogyny. I think that's hatred towards women. I think that prevents women from living out the fullness of what femininity is, God-given femininity, because being a woman is a reflection of the divine. God has masculine and feminine characteristics. Now, he self-describes as a man, but you think femininity just comes from nowhere? Of course not, friends. Of course not. Don't be ludicrous. Women are made in the image of God. Male and female, he created them in his image. Womanhood is the image of God in a different way than manhood is. But womanhood is the image of God. So, I've gone really long. I was not expecting to talk about this, but this is important. This is important for our culture today. This is important for our society today. It is important for women to know. You know, my daughter Eliza is a genius. You know, I haven't actually had her tested, but she's an incredibly intelligent young girl. Incredibly intelligent. And you know what I want for her? You know what I want for her? I want her to fulfill God's purpose for her life. And if God's purpose for her life is to go get a PhD or be a doctor or be a senator or a president, I want that for her. But you know what? If it's to be a good and godly wife and mother, I want that for her. I want God's will for her life. Now, I think God gave her a brilliant mind for her to use her brilliant mind in God's service, whatever that means, whatever that means. But I want her to live up her potential in God's will for her life. I my daughter is perfectly capable of someday becoming a medical doctor or becoming a scholar of high repute. I have no doubt about that. She's a very brilliant little girl. But I'm not going to try to force her to live out my dreams of academic influence because I want her to be something that I want. I want her to become what God wants, and I want her to become ultimately what she wants. I want her to find her own way to fulfill her femininity. And live out what it means to be a woman made in the image of God and to live out that image, because that's the call that all of us have. All of us are called by God to live out the image of God, to represent and to image God to the world. So that's what I want. Anyways, I've gone way, way, way too long. If you've listened through all of this, I hope that you appreciate some of the things I've said, and I would love to discuss these further if you're interested in that. Anyways, we will be back tomorrow with more Bible. Thank you. God bless.